some point we would hope that public opinion would be strong enough to move these people in Washington who are supposed to represent us. But then, you know, on the other side, they're listening to other advisors and big money interests and in regards to the war. So I don't know. The only thing I can say is that we just need to continue to keep it in the public eye and take every opportunity we can to raise the issues about, you know, why are we still at war? Why is the prison still open? Why are we still eroding civil liberties? And keep at it.
Madeline Hoffman is director of New Jersey Peace Action. And again, the candlelight vigil calling for the closure of the U.S. prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, is this Friday starting at 6:30 p.m. in Montclair, New Jersey. And that is some of the news for Wednesday, January 9th, 2013. Tonight's news was produced with Rebecca Miles and Linda Perry. Thank you for listening. I'm Jose Santiago in New York for the WBAI listener-sponsored news.
And the preceding, clearly a rebroadcast, of the WBAI evening news was, being a rebroadcast, brought to you on recording. The time is exactly midnight, and we hear next Robert Knight and Earthwatch. Please stay tuned.
The bell for freedom still rings. The bell for freedom still rings. Sorrow to me, but does it ring to know the bell of freedom still rings? The hammer for justice still pounds. The hammer for justice still pounds. Stop and see. Babies still starve. We can't have the biggest heart if millions of babies still starve. And the innocent ones still die. The innocent ones still die. We can't value life too high if the innocent ones still die. Stop and see. 'cause he looks upon us with a frown. Light of truth we won't let shine. Light of truth we won't let shine. Tell me, has the world gone blind? The light of truth we won't let shine. As long as there's life, there's still a day. As long as there's life, there's still a day. And I know that we can find our way. For as long as there's life, there's still a day.
Stephen Morris with our theme song here today on Earthwatch on WBAI 99.5 and WBAI.org on the web. My name is Robert Knight. This is our concluding program for the year 2010. And what a year it has been, one with deceptions in terms of the executive administration, with the promise of the reduction, but the fact of the increase of war. It has been a year of revelation, with WikiLeaks bringing a Promethean understanding of the true machinations of the foreign policy of the United States. It's been a year that saw the worst pollution of a body of water by oil pirates in the history of the United States. It saw the tragedy of the Haitian earthquake and the regripping of that nation by economic and military interests. We've seen the unreliability of the claim of democratic liberation in so many countries around the world. And we have seen the issue of energy intertwined with that of data. We saw a most unusual virus unleashed, ostensibly by agencies with great resources of unknown identity, releasing a virus, a Trojan horse called Stuxnet, that some people think were designed to disable the operations of the nation of Iran in what they insist is a civilian nuclear energy program. Someone familiar with that and so many other subjects is our first guest tonight, Scott Portzine, who you probably have seen on various media, including CNN, ABC, Dateline, and so on. He is a nuclear security expert. He is with Three Mile Island Alert. Three Mile Island is where this radio station cut its teeth on the no nukes issue and on the hazards to the environment thereof. And it's an honor to have you with us here tonight, Scott. Welcome to Earthwatch.
Thank you, Robert. My hat's off to you for being on top of this subject for years.
My God. Well, thank you. I mean, I just did what seemed to come naturally as an investigative journalist, to look deeper than the propaganda of the industries and the mainstream media.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of financing going on behind the scenes to create a new nuclear renaissance, as they say. But it's turning out to be a mirage, and companies are walking away from their plans. Selling some of their assets, dropping plans for new types of reactors. For instance, the pebble bed reactor, a couple of years ago that was dropped. That was supposed to be a new miracle reactor that was reported in Popular Science magazine, and a professor from MIT, KADEC. And, of course, KADEC turned out to be a nuclear profiteer, as I like to call him, and he's no longer working strictly as on the scholarly level, but he's promoting the resurgence of the nuclear energy. The pebble bed reactor, by the way, most people don't know this, had an accident 9 days after Chernobyl in Germany, there was another small nuclear accident at an experimental pebble bed reactor. The biggest problem with the pebble bed reactor is it relies upon perfect fuel pebbles. These are about the size of a tennis ball. No one has ever made one single perfect pebble for the pebble bed reactor, and they need about 100,000 of these in each reactor.
How is this different from the piles and the graphite rods that we know as a traditional fission reactor?
Well, the moderator, or the graphite in this case, is wrapped around the fuel, and that's the coating over that tennis ball. And they can't make that coating perfect. There's always a crack in it. There's always a flaw in it. They've never made one single one that didn't have a flaw.
Balloon go pop.
Well, that's what happens. They jam up, and it was a recycling-type situation where it was like burning pellets of fuel in a wood stove-type burner, and they circulated from top to bottom and then had to go back up to the top. Well, they jammed up, and then the graphite can catch on fire and release radiation, and that's what happened in Germany.
Our guest is Scott Portzine, and already you have advanced the plot with your comments about the so-called new containment technology. But, Scott, I'd like to back up to a wider angle here just for a moment, because President Obama, during the year 2010, made an announcement that, I guess it was a myth on top of a myth, when he said, in order to reduce our dependence on foreign oil, and I don't know what oil is foreign to the planet Earth, that we're going to renew our commitment to nuclear energy. And here in the transition of years, I'd like you to take your time and assess whether that is a viable strategy and what truly is happening with the nuclear industry today.
Okay. Well, first of all, our energy dependence, oil dependence, I should say, has nothing to do with nuclear. Nuclear creates electricity in this country. Only 2%, less than 2% of the electricity generated in the United States comes from oil, and that is in Hawaii. And two-thirds of that comes from, they get their oil from Asia. So there again, two-thirds of that small percentage is foreign oil that's producing that electricity. There's another myth that I'd like to have people come to grips with. They talk about we must end our dependence on foreign oil, and as you say, it's everybody's oil, so to speak, the planet's oil, and that not only do we steal it, rob it, and create economies with it and dollar values with it, but we pollute each other with it also. If we, in fact, as a nation, strategically decided to use up our oil supplies that we are claiming is ours, then we really are over the barrel when we have run out of oil. That's if you believe that oil is a finite source. There's a lot of new information in recent years that says oil is not a finite source, that it is a geological process that creates oil, not from fossil plants, fossilized plants and so forth. So when we hear politicians say about we're going to end our dependency on foreign oil, that will never be a strategic military or economic plan for the United States. No gaming, no war gamer, no military strategist will ever say, yeah, let's use all of ours first, and then we'll try to get some later from another hostile country, let alone a friendly country, too. So I don't think people should get all excited about ending our dependence on foreign oil with nuclear, because we can do all of our energy, I'm getting ahead of myself, I'm going to come back to what you're saying, we can supply all of our energy through wind, solar, water, and off the top of my head, wind, water, and solar. That's the only three we need. And there's a Scientific American article from November of last year that was really good describing that plan, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But what has happened in the nuclear realm, Obama's been pressured to continue this nuclear resurgence, and there's military reasons to do that. Every single nuclear program in the world feeds it weapons program. That's where they get some of the nuclear materials, the special nuclear materials, the plutonium, the deuterium and the tritium, and some of the boosters that they can literally dial a yield with these nuclear missiles, where they control how much boosting goes on by adding these gases to the blend, so to speak. And so nuclear power is a military asset and a military problem everywhere. And, of course, this is what we're seeing right now, especially in Iran and in North Korea. And so with the pressures comes the feasibility of the economics, and economics are totally against nuclear power. In Pennsylvania, nuclear energy costs more than any of the other traditional powers until recently. Wind was more expensive, but now wind is cheaper than nuclear. So we were always told that nuclear power is clean, cheap, and safe. And the safety record certainly can be argued, and it carries bigger risk than any other form of power, that's for sure. But it's never been clean, and it has a very special pollutant, and costs a lot of money to take care of that type of pollutant. And so what has happened economically, the industry has asked and pressured the government and the military through the indirect connection there for loan agreements that they did not want to spend up front $8 to $10 to $12 billion to construct one nuclear plant, and that they knew it was a financial risk. Wall Street would have nothing to do with it. Wall Street runs away with the nuclear, away from people planning nuclear. And so in order to go through with it, the government said, well, we'll have to guarantee some of these loans, and they're trying to milk the taxpayers for $32 to $50 billion to get the first round of nuclear plants started. And ratepayers in Florida and South Carolina are already paying an increase in their rates, even though the plants aren't under construction yet. They've started to till the ground, so to speak, but nothing has been built, and they've already spent $1 billion in each state.
Scott, what you're saying actually has some hope within it. It's the first discussion I've had involving nuclear power that had that component.
Well, yeah, it falls apart under its own weight. It's a technology that requires so much rocket science and follow-up that they can't do it feasibly. It's like the pursuit of fusion. Right now, we don't understand enough science to create a fusion reaction, which would be a great way to go. Fusion, by the way, uses hydrogen and helium and the elements that only have a couple of electrons. And the dangerous ones, the radioactive ones, are at the other end of the spectrum, the uranium and the plutonium, the thorium, the strontium, cobalt, and these types of things.
So small is green is good.
Yeah, in this particular case, yes.
Even in the atomic realm. Scott, one of the things that we have discussed in the past is the junction between nuclear technology and data technology. You and I have spoken in the past about Insidious virus, Trojan horse, called Stuxnet, which popped on the scene with what appeared to be tremendous undisclosed resources for its creation. That by all analysts, and we spoke with the security director of Symantec about this, Liam Amirchu, called Stuxnet, which appeared to be targeted against either the nuclear facility or the fuel processing facilities of the data mechanical machines that create the process for safely producing fuel and the atomic energy reactions and so on. And I would be remiss not to ask you, what is your latest understanding of the issue of Stuxnet?
Yeah, they've really had a problem in Iran now. We just learned in the last few days that 1,000 of the 10,000 centrifuges have been destroyed from this virus. And what would happen, these motors have to spin very rapidly, and the Stuxnet virus took over the microprocessors. It's a microcomputer that sends electronic signals and frequencies for these motors to drive these rotors, and it would spin them too fast or oscillate between a proper setting and a very high setting until it destroyed the motors by destroying bearings or just falling apart, and maybe even the seals, I'm supposing. So some scientists, cyber scientists, originally thought that the purpose of the Stuxnet virus was to secretly cause the uranium enrichment process to be flawed without destroying the rotors, without destroying the machinery, and that it would hide and just constantly stop the Iranians, halt their process.
A poison pill that would give back bad data about the purity of the process and then cause later problems?
That they would never be able to figure it out. But now that they've discovered, they think 1,000 of the centrifuges were destroyed, they're rethinking what the Stuxnet has done. Incidentally, I read an article today in Popular Mechanics, and it said how easy it is to get rid of the Stuxnet virus with these industrial-grade antivirus software. Boy, couldn't that be further from the truth. The Iranians have been infected with 62,000 machines have been infected, and there's experts saying if they don't absolutely get rid of those machines, they'll just continue to reinfect themselves. On the 16th of November, the Bushehr nuclear processing plant finally shut down all of its centrifuges because they just were not having success. It was continually deteriorating, as if the virus, it indicates to some people that the virus was still spreading. And there are cybersecurity experts that believe that they will have problems with this for years, and that they will absolutely have to clean house of all their computers and make disconnects from all their suppliers and contractors, and it's just going to be a mess. But see, it's not going to stop there. Of course, if it's that bad, then it's already hit other nations, including ours. And so we don't know what the end results are going to be with this, and we don't know what some clever hackers are going to do now that they understand more about that code and can obtain it and information about that code.
Our guest is Scott Portzine, and he is a nuclear security expert. He is with Three Mile Island Alert. Among his many appearances have been CNN, ABC, Dateline, and the United States Congress. Am I correct?
Yes, that's right. That was written testimony. I've testified in person to many other committees, but in 1993 I provided written testimony about how easy it was to attack a United States nuclear plant using publicly available documents, and that the documents should be available, but that security needed to be improved. We have a right to be critical of safety concerns and risks that are associated with businesses that are in our area that we live. What other industry has the ability to wipe out my entire state, making it unlivable, ruining trillions of dollars in economics? So I think citizens need to be at the meetings and need to have the documents and need to educate themselves so they know how to insist on changes and try to get these people to do the right thing. And that's really becoming difficult lately.
Scott, there's another area that I feel we must explore together. And I think the Stuxnet was the fulcrum of transitioning from the nuclear debate to the technotronic, the cyber debate. And in some of our conversations, I've raised the question, and I think you're sensitive to my concern, that I've been immersed in the beautiful revelations, the Promethean fire brought to the citizens about the behavior of their government, ostensibly on their behalf, through the State Department with the WikiLeaks most recent release of so many things where policy is the opposite of publicity. And this brings us to the real nexus of next year's and next century's challenge about information. Because the dissemination of the WikiLeaks is so highly dependent upon the Internet, which, of course, I presume everyone knows was originally a Pentagon invention from DARPANET, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. It became a common carrier. It became part of the commonweal as it went from science to being civilianized. It became a route for commerce. And with the freedom of transmissions implicit in that, it became temporarily, before advertising took over, a liberationist tool. And among the fruits of that has been WikiLeaks, many other things as well. And now what we're seeing are several levels of attack about that freedom of information. We've been seeing institutional attacks with the denial of service attacks on the WikiLeaks website, but more insidious than that, the economic and political attacks on economic common carriers like Visa and MasterCard and Amazon and PayPal, all of which bowed to government pressure and tried to cut off the legal defense fund of co-founder Julian Assange. And it seems to me, Scott, that we are in a new, dare I say, nuclear battleground of freedom of information. And here's my key question to you. The enforcement, as we've learned through WikiLeaks, the strong-arming of the government of Spain, of the United Kingdom, by the United States under the false flag of the recording industry, the U.S. played some hardball and made Spain and England and other countries submit to tracking Internet addresses, of gathering maximum data of permanent identification of individuals, and tracking what they download. Now, ostensibly, that's to do digital rights management, copyright of music. You know, this, when you share, you're unfair, you know. But I have a more ominous suspicion that if the United States government and its agencies can engage in operations to shut down peer-to-peer networks, to do denial-of-service attacks, to attack WikiLeaks, and prevent people from downloading the insurance file from WikiLeaks. If they can stop records, they can stop other freedoms of information. And here's the big question for tonight, Scott Fortzein. If the USG, United States government, can use commercial copyright as a false flag to shut down, monitor, or otherwise freeze the Internet, do you fear that they might have an intention of preventing us from getting files such as insurance.aes256, of being able to share the wealth of information from the revelation of WikiLeaks? Do you see anything deeper and darker on the horizon?
Oh, yeah. The government of the world are going to demand some. I foresee it'll be so bad that you will not be able to log on to your computer without your thumbprint or your eye scan. And then there'll be another series of security checks that you'll have to go through, maybe voice recognition and several numbers and more than just your high school and your first car, you know, that kind of stuff. And that there'll probably be three separate internets. And then there'll be secret ones beyond that we will never know about for years. And that.
Pardon me for interrupting. One of the things I love learning from the WikiLeaks is SIPRNet, Secret Internet Protocol, maintained by the Pentagon. I had not known of that before.
I'd never heard of the name of it, but I've known that it existed. And, yeah, there's very high-speed internets where it's 100 times faster than anything we have now. But I do foresee a time where you will be personally held responsible for everything that you download, read, or disseminate from your computer, and that they will instantly know who has done it. Because you will have to log on with your thumbprint and so forth. And they will shut down quite a bit of information in the future, and at least the fear of being caught will become tremendous. And so they might actually segregate the Internet into regions where one thing that makes it hard to find cyber hackers these days is the amount of computers they go through around the world before they hit the one they want to attack can be, in the dozens. So if they break down regions and you can't get out of your regions without your papers, like you're traveling in the former Soviet bloc, you're not going to go anywhere they don't want you to go. And I really think that's going to happen someday, because they can't come up with enough security to clog all the holes that exist now and will be created in the future. After all, if you're going to have computers communicate to each other, there has to be at least one hole somewhere, and hackers will always be able to exploit that hole. So they'll have to go to another technique, and I think it's going to be draconian. I have personal experience with the overreaction of government to information on the Internet, and that happened, I guess that was about the year 2004. And if you Google my name at CNN, you'll see an article there called Blueprint for Terrorists. And we, meaning me and a few other nuclear activists, saw that the NRC was providing too much information from a database that anyone could access from their home computer that showed where dangerous nuclear materials were located in universities and hospitals, not only what the address was, but what floor, what room, what closet, what shelf, what drawer, and so forth. And it even described what security may or may not have existed at that building. So we have been pressuring the NRC to get rid of that particular page or two in each one of those reports, and there are hundreds of them, and they said, no, that's not necessary. Finally, NBC was about to air a report based on my research that evening, and the NRC shut down its entire database. It wiped out or eliminated access to hundreds of thousands of documents that deserve to be in the hands of the public, as I said earlier, for safety reasons and concerns, and for us to look over their shoulder, be sure that they are doing their jobs properly. And they pulled everything off. So, there were a few people who were critical of me for causing that problem. They did reinstate the database. It took about 6 months, but they purged those particular pages and not the whole document. And that was the proper way to handle that. But when you think about the reaction that's going to come from hundreds of agencies, not just one federal agency, the NRC, it's going to be draconian. And so what they're going to probably have to do is identify who each user is, and you're not going to go anywhere unless they can identify you.
That's my friend, our guest, Scott Portsign. And you started out so optimistically about the decline of nuclear energy as a policy solution. And here we are. Scott, I thank you so much for taking the time that you have so far, knowing your commitments in the morning. I have my own as well. But let me just bring this to a close by asking you to take a blue sky and say whatever you want. Our theme tonight is about a happier and more peaceful new year. What retro observations or what guideposts do you see for the next year?
Well, the good news is that the Department of Energy's plan for 20% of the electricity being provided by wind power by the year 2030 is going well. We're ahead of schedule for that. And if you look at the article I was talking about in Scientific American, or go to the Stanford University's website and read about their energy planning and what they have studied, they're saying that we can get all of our energy, not only the supply business and your home, but your vehicle, from wind, water, and solar power by the year 2030. Because let's face it, there is far more energy coming into this earth from the sun, which is also wind power, by the way, than we can possibly use. So if we can tap into that and convert it to the energy and distribute it the way we need to, we will solve a lot of economic problems. We will create jobs. We'll cut down on pollution. We'll cut down on the need to pay an endless nuclear waste bill that will go on longer than we've had recorded history. And it just solves a lot of problems. So that's the good news. We're on the way to doing that. The technologies are actually here now. There's a few things that they need to resolve with some of the materials for the wind turbines to make them work better. But they don't need, you know, there's all these myths out there about, oh, if we've covered the planet with, you know, the whole United States with wind turbines, it still wouldn't be enough. It's just not true. And so all of that's in that article and the studies you can read about and overcome a lot of these beliefs that the anti-alternative energy people spout. And I think that's kind of a strange label that you don't hear, anti-alternative energy. But they call people who are against nuclear power anti-nuclear or anti-nukes. Why would anybody be against alternative energy? And it's sustainable energy. It's renewable energy. It's clean. It gives power to the people instead of to the oil companies. That's all I have. I hope everybody has a happy new year, and we will have some things to celebrate next year, I believe.
Scott, how can people keep track of your work? Scott Portzine is a very important man who's been seen on ABC, CNN, and many other places, including the United States Congress. He's a nuclear security expert. He is also with Three Mile Island Alert. You're one of the, that organization is one of the elders of our wisdom today. And how can people keep track of your work?
Well, we do have a website, www.tmia.com. It's not org, because that was already taken, so we had to go with com. And I'm not happy with the website now. I used to have a lot, it used to be a lot easier to get around, but you can read the current things that are going on there.
Well, thank you. You have been brilliant, and I look forward to our next encounter. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Robert.
Scott Portzine, right. My hero. We'll talk some more.
Oh, I just don't know where to begin. Though it says I'm here forever, it's now or never. But you keep some hanging on the silver chandelier. She says she can't go home without a chaperone. Oh,
This is Earthwatch on WBAI in New York or WBAI.org on the web. You're listening to the 2010 closeout edition of Earthwatch. My name is Robert Knight, and we've been speaking about energy and cybernetics with Scott Portzine. And there's no other way to close out a year than with the scholar of the albedo, of the tilt and rotation of the planet Earth, our decades-long friend and colleague and celestial analyst, Steve Cates, here with a year transition report with a special edition of Skywatch here on Earthwatch. Welcome, Steve.
And good morning, Robert. Happy holidays and happy new year to you and the listeners. Appreciate the nice introduction, and just wanted to mention in passing that I hope folks in the New York area had an opportunity to see the total eclipse of the moon. I was out on a cruise ship, the very first vacation that I can actually call a vacation that I've really ever had, somewhere down in the Caribbean Sea, actually in the Gulf of Mexico, watching that on board a beautiful cruise ship, and to the entertainment and amazement of many of the folks on board who've never seen one of nature's most amazing events. I was so impressed because of the latitude that we were at. We sailed all the way down to Montego Bay in Jamaica. And as many listeners, of course, know, looking up in those skies during this time of the year, I got to see for the first time in my life some of those beautiful southern constellations. But, folks, again, Happy New Year as we move out of 2010 into this new decade. Well, Robert, so many interesting things are happening, and I want to mention something in the form of kind of an alert here and kind of a small bulletin for the Earthwatch audience with our Skywatch report. I wonder if many folks are privy to the fact that there is an incredible storm raging on the cloud tops of Saturn. This news came to us, actually, to the astronomers at the Cassini Solstice mission, the NASA folks, earlier this particular month by about the 6th. The Cassini spacecraft was watching some very interesting activity happening on board the northern hemisphere, or that is the northern latitudes of the planet Saturn. And lo and behold, this storm, and I might add that it's a tremendous electrical storm, the size of the planet Earth. We all know of the great storm that just moved up the east coast and obviously is something that nobody can forget, being in that particular part of the country right now. I'm sure everybody understands the full fury of nature, but can we imagine on an even larger scale on the planet Saturn, as I like to describe it, the original ring planet, this planet that Galileo himself never fully understood what those immense rings, as we know them today, were actually, he thought, two large orbs, or as he called them, ears of the giant Saturn. But going back to Saturn right now, sky watchers with telescopes with moderate magnification, and I'm saying that you can see this particular storm if you follow where it is on the cloud tops of the planet Saturn. It's not in one position because it's rotating, of course, as the planet turns in Saturn's a little over 10-hour day. But when you see this, when it moves front and center to the hemisphere that faces the Earth, it's amazing. Because the planet Saturn's clouds have generally been very much unlike that of Jupiter. Jupiter obviously has all the turbidity in its atmosphere, but Saturn, for the most part, has been relatively calm. And it's very unusual, and that's why when we talk about this, so in simple English, if folks go out and have a telescope and point it towards Saturn, Saturn, by the way, is easily seen in the morning sky to the upper right of the beautiful planet Venus. You can't mistake that in the southeast. But if you try this and you're having a little difficulty finding Saturn, here's how to try it, to find it, I should say. Place your thumb over the planet's Venus, the bright planet, and then just up as the clock would go, say, about 1 or 2 o'clock, where your index finger would point up higher to the right, above into the southeast, you'll see this easy-to-see object with the naked eye. That's Saturn. And then simply just point the telescope, and if you have a magnification of a little over 100, maybe even 100 or maybe 200 times the magnification of the eye, very common in basic telescopes, I assure you, if that position where the clouds are is facing the Earth, you'll get an opportunity to see this large streak with a long tail all across the planet, something that's amazing. And since the web does better justice to this, if you're not one who has a telescope or maybe wants to brave the cold, simply go on to the NASA website for Cassini Solstice Mission. If you just Google Cassini Solstice Mission, you'll go right to the raw images and also the processed images that this particular spacecraft known as the Cassini mission or Cassini Solstice mission is still, Robert, taking some amazing pictures of this most amazing planet. So a raging storm on Saturn is the big news right now. But folks, just a quick Skywatch report, and then as the time permits, we'll try to go to the top of the hour here and just give everybody at least a sneak preview of what's happening skywise in the year 2011. Well, first, folks, in the real-time view, as I mentioned before, if you look into the southeast just before dawn, that brilliant object is the planet Venus, Saturn, of course, just to the upper right, about 15 degrees away. In your evening sky, simply look high into the south at sunset. The planet Jupiter continues to reign king, and a very interesting planet indeed. You can see many of those four Galilean satellites as they continue to do that romance and dance across the equatorial plane of this most mighty planet, the planet Jupiter. Right now, as we move toward the 30th of December 2010, the moon, of course, as we know, moving into its waning phases, and just now, very much past its last quarter phase. And interestingly, as we move into the early part of January, the moon is new on the 4th. But lo and behold, we come across, Robert, probably one of the best meteor showers of the entire year. Well, what year? Well, it'll be 2011 before we know it. Skywatchers looking into the northeastern sky, if you take a look high up into the northeast, say between 3 a.m. and sunrise on both the mornings of January the 3rd and the 4th, you may get to see meteors, and somewhat intense this shower can be. A shower called the quadranted meteor shower. Probably haven't heard of that one because very few people know much about it, even the astronomers, as we talk about many times on this show. Most of the meteors are thought to come from the debris from comets. Well, this one, particularly like the Geminids, may come from an extinct asteroid collision. So if you're up and looking into the northeastern sky on the early morning hours, January 3rd and 4th, you may get to see a good sky show. Astronomers tell us that the actual peak is at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on January the 3rd, but unfortunately that constellation doesn't rise until the early morning hours, so go figure. But here, as we wrap it up, Robert, some really interesting things happening in our skies for the month, I should say the year of 2011, some really cool things that will be happening in the sky. January, as I mentioned, the great meteor shower known as the Quadrantids. And then the planet Mercury, in the month of March, as we find out, this particular object will conjunct or come close together with the planet Jupiter by about the 16th of March, making it a beautiful sight in the sky. Mercury's a hard planet to see, the innermost planet. Jupiter, obviously, easy. They'll make for a beautiful conjunction low into the western sky just after sunset on March the 16th. And then, we have a really phenomenal conjunction of planets. If we look into the skies of May 2011, we get to see on the early morning hours of May the 11th, how about this, three objects in the sky, maybe even four if you count it as a conjunction, but the dominant two will be Jupiter and Venus. Two of the most brilliant planets will conjunct together during the early morning hours, about 30 minutes before sunrise, on the morning of May 11th, and that'll be a beautiful sight. And just to the lower right of Venus will be Mercury, still technically visible to the naked eye. And the planet Mars, just to the lower right of the planet Jupiter, now getting much brighter as it starts to return closer to the Earth in the year 2011. And then Venus actually will transition from the morning sky into the evening sky in September. But we also have to talk about, Robert, the return of the planet Saturn to our skies. Now, we talked about Saturn in the morning sky, but Saturn reaches its best time for all of 2011 as it reaches opposition, as it moves, of course, into the month of April 2011, when the planet itself will be very, very bright throughout a good portion of the month of April. Opposition, that is on April the 3rd. And then another spectacular planet that we've just talked about is the planet Jupiter, and it, too, returns once again to its great opposition, meaning it's visible all night long. And this time, we find that the planet itself, the planet Jupiter, will be best by the 28th of October of the new year, 2011. And then for meteor showers, we may get a good one in the Leonids in 2011 on the 16th and 17th of November, as the moon will be at its last quarter phase and not really interfering. And for folks that may have missed this particular eclipse of the moon, the total eclipse of the moon that we just experienced about a week or so ago, we have an almost repeat, but you need to be on the western side of the United States, and the Pacific Ocean in the state of Hawaii is most favored. But we get kind of a repeat of that beautifully eclipsed moon. Out here in the west, the moon will reach totality as it's just about setting. That in itself will be beautiful. And again, as I mentioned, this particular total lunar eclipse for sky watchers will occur on the 10th of December, 2011. And Robert, I saved the actual best for last, but it's actually something that will happen in the year 2012, of all auspicious years. Don't forget, folks, the second of these two dynamic transits of the planet Venus will actually happen on June the 5th or the 6th, depending on where you live, on the date of June the 5th or the 6th, out in the Pacific Ocean or for the western part of the United States in 2012. And if you miss this very rare alignment, I saw the one in 2004, we'll have to wait another lifetime. And sadly, none of us today will be able to see it. The Venus transits will occur once again in the year 2117. And as always, if you'd like to learn more about the wonders of the night sky and a whole lot more from our aviation sister websites and everything, visit us at www.drsky.com. And Robert, again, thank you for having me on board this interplanetary, intergalactic spaceship of the mind as we talk about events and things in the sky, where many people told us a long time ago that you cannot see many things from the biggest and largest cities in the world, and I think we've proven them wrong because, Robert, you and I have been doing this, almost a generation or so, and I do really appreciate that. And once again, the best for a great 2011 for each and every one of the listeners, and particularly to you, my friend, as we continue to close out 2010. Thank you so much.
Steve, 2010 was just us beginning, and we have so much more to come. Thank you for being as brilliant as you have been in the universe here on Earthwatch.
Well, thank you for your kind comments, and Happy New Year to all. Thank you.
This is Earthwatch on WBAI New York. That was Steve Cates with the Skywatch Report. We'll be back with more, including your thoughts about the transition of the decade, of the year. 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. End of year thoughts on this end of year broadcast of Earthwatch. Brother, brother, brother. This is Earthwatch on WBAI New York. That was Seal and Annie Lennox, thoughts for the end of the year, or the beginning of a decade, depending on how you look at it. Phone number is 212-209-2900, and a lot of calls, you're on the air. Hello. This is Earthwatch, and you're on the air.
Hello, Robert Knight, it's Jeremiah.
Jeremiah, man, I so enjoyed your concert. We did stuff so long ago with Earth Driver, and you're just as much a captain of Earth consciousness. How are you?
I'm doing great, and I'm very much enjoying your program this evening.
Tell people who you are.
Well, I'm a bassist. I'm a producer. I'm an activist. I'm an avid BAI listener. I recently founded a record label called EarthDriver.org, which I'm really excited about. I encourage people to go there. We just actually recently uploaded a free lecture courtesy of the Brecht Forum and Verso Books of Slavo Zizek when he spoke at the Brecht Forum. Cooper Union a couple years ago. And we have Doug Wimbish, who's a bass legend, recently on our label. For those of you who don't know Doug, I strongly encourage you come to the show we're putting together on January 22nd at the Brooklyn Lyceum. Doug is really a historical figure that's really under-recognized for his contribution in music, and I'm so thrilled. It really is a dream come true. So I'm so focused on that concert, which is one reason why I'm calling January 22nd at the Brooklyn Lyceum. But, you know, I'm a BAI listener, I'm so excited about all the programming I get to enjoy every day, and I'm really excited about a 5 o'clock shadow as well. I've been trying to catch that daily.
Oh, you heard, huh?
Oh, it's great, man, and I'm really excited you're able to share your brilliance with the listenership because this information is just so crucial. And I'm a bit of an information junkie, so BAI helps me with that.
You know, Let me just get into the muse that you experience. I mean, obviously, you're a conscious man, you're a political man, you're a digital man, and yet you are a creative man with such lyrical sensitivity and pungent wit in your musical compositions.
Thank you.
And I myself, you know, in different modalities, I might do formalistic news at a certain moment, or a free form like this at another.
Right.
And in this free form space, everything, including wit, humor, satire, is permissible. And, you know, it's not to be judged by extraterritorial standards.
Right.
And yet, you produce music. And, you know, I've studied astrology, I've studied mathematics, and I think music is the most superior language I've yet encountered.
You know, it's a great quote from Beethoven. He said something to the effect of, you know, when I look at the world, I must sigh, because I see a world that does not understand that music is a higher revelation than all wisdom and all philosophy. And as a musician, I can't help but agree with that. So, you know, there is a, you know, it is incredible, actually, as I study music, because I am a student of the bass as I continue to produce my music and produce events. I mean, it's a never-ending study. As Richard Bona, I don't know if you're familiar with Richard Bona, but he's one of the greatest bass players in the world, a Cameroonian bassist and singer and total sensation. And, you know, another person I'm honored to call my teacher. But, you know, Richard Bona years ago said something to me that really stuck with me. He just said simply, music is a lifetime thing. It's a lifetime study. It never ends. And it really is. To me, it is studying the laws of the universe.
I'm not to gainsay that, but I'm hearing two extra syllables. Music is, what was it, music is a lifetime thing?
Yeah. So it's a life.
And I'm thinking, music is a life.
Right, it is. It is. You have to live with your work, whatever you may do, whatever art you may prefer. I do believe that is the key, is live with your work.
Well, but I'm thinking about, all right, tonight, for instance, we talked about some real heavy factual data stuff. And if that were to be made a song, how do you go from, like, news mode into catching a person's heart and making them laugh or feel?
It's a great question. I think people sort of impose an unnecessary dichotomy on the intellectual mind and the creative mind, because I think, you know, you can freely go from one to another. That's what it is to be human, and we should enjoy that. So, for example, I read, you know, Michio Kaku, and, you know, I'm not a physicist. I can get some of it as a layman, as somebody who's just interested in the sciences, but I can't really fully grasp what he's saying, because I'm not a professional physicist, but I can immediately take that inspiration and just take a word that catches my eye, or an idea, and then I might specifically write a song where the idea is to take that word and that concept and to sing a whole thing about something, but to hide what I'm singing about from the listener. So it's something I could let you in on later. But I want to paint all the imagery around something. That would be, for example, one way of trying to write a song. But writing a song, it's a playful thing. Actually, there's a great book a friend of mine got me by the songwriter Jimmy Webb. It's called Tunesmith.
One of the greatest ever, Jimmy Webb.
Yeah,
by the
Jimmy
time
Webb,
I get to that
songwriter.
Book, she'll be rising.
You're right. And one thing I learned from that book is that every way that you could think to write a song, it's legit, and it's been done before. You can sing a melody and fill in the words later. You can have words on paper and apply a melody to that. You can have music and put words over the music, or you can have words and put music to the words. All you can do, every variable, and it's all valid. There's not a right way or a better way of doing it. It's all been done in songwriting, and they're all great ways to write songs. So I think, you know, unlike in the sciences, we have the freedom to just, you know, maybe play with someone and say it's a wrong note. We could be dissonant intentionally. We can do things that it's subjective. It's art. You know, everybody has an opinion, and it's art. We're not dealing with the instruments of science, but we can be inspired by science. We can be inspired by the technical pursuit. And I think, you know, even if you look at some of the great scientists, even like Einstein, you know, it wasn't just math. It was a lot of creativity. You know, one thing I don't know if you know, Robert, but I'm a chess teacher. I've been teaching children how to play chess for the past 7 years. And one thing a lot of people don't know about the game of chess is that the world champion at any given time is a wildly creative player. He's not just the cold calculator who can just calculate all the moves and see everything. He's the guy who's seeing possibilities that no one else is seeing in an artistic sense. You know, so there's always that element. There's like the creativity fuels the technical mind, and the technical mind can inspire and inform the creativity.
Oh, man, you just making me feel bigger than Jupiter.
Well, that's great.
This is
man.
A brilliant conversation.
Are you familiar with a great documentary called Game Over? About when Garry Kasparov played the computer Deep Blue for the second time?
No, I've not read that, although I have followed the great chess tournaments. I'm just a, what's a putzer? What's the term?
Potzer.
Potzer. But I enjoy chess puzzles.
Right.
And, you know, when I was a little boy, I learned chess by taking my grandmother's red and white checkerboard tablecloth and cutting out figures in the
wow.
shapes of the figures of the chess pieces. And I never called a rook a castle.
Nice. Nice.
I didn't know that was one of your skills.
Yeah, I was on one of the best elementary school chess teams in the country. And, you know, I was a patser, you know, myself. I was just, one of my best friends was an excellent player. And I just sort of started hanging around and picked up chess that way. But I didn't have that intense background that a lot of the kids who were really, you know, very competitive, you know, had. But I started getting in the tournament scene, and I played in chess tournaments in my fourth, fifth, and sixth grade. And then I didn't play for years. And then a friend of mine said, hey, would you be interested in doing this job? And I've been doing it for 7 years, and I actually love working with the kids, and I've rediscovered chess, which has been great.
Well, Jeremiah, it's been an enlightenment, as it always is with you. And you mentioned that you're performing on the 22nd of
June. 22nd. And if I may say something about this event, I really want the BAI community to be there, because I'm really trying to put you know, an event together that's a community event. I really want to move away from the nightclub experience.
And, even though you rocked at the Blue Note.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. And, you have to play in those venues. I'm not protesting those venues, but I want to move away from that sort of, you know, late night drinking kind of scene. And this event is really, it's a community event. You know, there's going to be activist organizations tabling. There'll be some arts and crafts. There'll be food. I know you can't say the price on the air on BAI, but it's very affordable. And Doug Wimbish, if you don't know him, he's in the house band for the Sugar Hill Gang, and he's the bassist for Living Color. And in the meantime, he's played on Seal albums, Madonna albums, Bjork albums. I mean,
played some Seal tonight.
Yeah, I heard that. And Doug is just, it's such a great thing to work with this brother because, I mean, he's really a hero to me. And it's such a great thing to meet one of your heroes and for that guy to be one of the coolest people you could ever meet on the planet. So, you know, Doug, it's an honor for me to present this event featuring Doug, and I really encourage people to be there. And like I said, there's going to be a lot of good information circulating as well at the Brooklyn Lyceum, January 22nd. It's going to be an early event. From 6 to 9 p.m. It's not the late night hang. 6 to 9 p.m.
And that'll be on Earth Driver, the website?
Yeah, we'll be up soon. You know, actually, our web designer is out of the country right now, so we're kind of waiting for him to get back to get that on the homepage. But, you know, you can check us out on Facebook. Definitely go to earthdriver.org and grab my free song, grab a free song monster, grab the Zizek lecture, check out my interview with Ornette Coleman. Very candid interview with Ornette Coleman in his living room. He's an old family friend, and you know, there's a lot of interesting things going on at EarthDriver.org.
Well, we'll be playing some of that on EarthWatch.
We have
to certainly
do.
Bringing our posse, and I'll try to use our good offices here at the station to bring even more.
Well, that would be great. And actually, I hope somehow BAI could table at the event if that's possible. I really want more and more people to know about the station, and you know, I've been talking to you about it, and we'll talk later, but really want to do this big BAI benefit concert. You know, I want to bring it all together where some of those downtown independent art people know they need to also tune into the independent radio station on a daily basis so we could be on the same wavelength.
Well, Jeremiah, you've certainly added the crown to the cranium of the thought of tonight's show.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Robert. It's always a pleasure, and, you know, everybody, you know, stay tuned.
All right. And here's something for you. It's Jimmy Webb singing his own song. This is Earthwatch on WBAI. Yeah, that's actually him, Jimmy Webb, the writer of that song and so many other great ones. I know you think of MacArthur Park and so many other things, but he helped a lot of people grow up into emotional maturity and did that in such a beautiful musical way. Speaking of growing, this is our end of year Earthwatch, and we're contemplating the old and the new, the end of a year and the beginning of a decade. And who better to discuss that with than my friend Jim Freund? You know, a lot of people are talking about how wonderful it is to have us in sequence with each other.
It really works thematically. It really plays from the science to the fiction. Yeah, in so many ways, and mm-hmm. from political speculations and reality into the politics of what
if. Do we have doing speculative
if?
Politics? Because I learned that phrase from you about speculative fiction.
Ah, well, I learned that phrase from reading Robert Heinlein.
Mm.
People think it's a very new phrase. It's from 1946, speculative fiction.
Jim Freund is the host of the legendary program Hour of the Wolf, one of the great intellectual pinnacles here at WBAI. And as I intimated early in the program, tonight is one of those nights. It's a free-form night. It is a neglected craft that was perfected right here in these metaphorical time-space display studios.
Mm-hmm. Certainly over the crystals through which we broadcast the and people don't know, it really is a crystal. It's the crystal that vibrates 99.5 million times every second that makes 99.5 FM.
By the hair of my chinny chin cat's whisker.
Something wicked this way, bats? I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's certainly these crystals that crystallized freeform radio. I guess it could be argued, I think, that Henry Morgan and Gene Shepard.
Gene Shepard, of course, Gene Shepard.
Well, Gene,
perhaps
Shepard
Steve
was,
Allen also.
Steve Allen was somewhat scripted. Although, I mean, he did the ad hoc interview. Yeah,
yes,
he did the ad hoc interview.
Yeah.
And a lot of that he did over WBAI.
That I did not know.
Not to forget that. Over the commercial station.
Wow.
WBAI, before 1960.
Hmm.
But Hugh Downs was also in BAI in those days.
Hugh Downs. I've got to reveal that during the days of Conjugate and Undercurrents, Hugh Downs was a great secret cybernetic patron to our work at that time.
Ah, really?
Yes, okay. He did. He provided certain computer hardware that was very useful to our investigations.
I was not aware of that.
Yeah.
I was not aware
good
of
man.
That.
Good man.
Yeah, and so he was at WBAI like in the late 50s, but the progenitors of freeform radio, I guess, are those two. Shepard, a little more rehearsed than not, because he's doing prepared stories.
Well, that's like jazz. Jazz is freeform, but you don't play jazz unless you rehearse.
You don't play jazz unless you rehearse, and you generally have your basic melody. You know it's going to be My Funny Valentine, Nature Boy. You know.
No, I prefer it the way you said it.
Yes,
I prefer my funny Valentine.
There you go. But you know, Ornette Coleman doesn't happen until later, you know, that kind of completely. And why do they call that kind of jazz? Freeform jazz.
Yeah.
It's not just improv. All jazz properly is improv, if it's truly jazz. Mm-hmm.
I was at a party once in East Harlem, and it was black, and it was beautiful, and it was brilliant, and it was poetic, and it was political, and it was artistic. And one of the performers was the pianist for Roberta Flack.
Mm.
And everything in the room moved as if the world were immersed in acid. It was just a beautiful, beautiful night,
mm-hmm.
or day, or two. I don't exactly remember. But
might have been both.
I never forgot what that pianist said as the room, you know, moved in waves and applauded, you know, like the tide coming in. And at the end of it, he said, no, we were saying, like, thank you, that was beautiful. No, man. I didn't do it. I was just here when it happened.
And that's true, but that's true to both.
Yeah.
But I think those people were the progenitors of freeform. And then it was really on these airwaves mm-hmm. with FAS that yeah. that freeform becomes an art, that it becomes an understood, practiced thing. And there was a long time where do you remember we had a freeform department?
Yes. D&L, we had many things, but
well,
for D&L, freeform.
Absolutely. But after D&L, are concurrent to it in later days.
I forget what that stood for.
Drama and literature.
I thought it was drugs and liquor.
Well, that, no, that's not true. We didn't
absolutely
have,
not.
We didn't have any liquor.
No.
Oh.
Yes.
So,
see, always the precise logician, Jim Freud.
Wow. Yeah, I guess.
We're thinking, you know, about this being the annual and decadal transition moment. This is our last broadcast of Earth Watch, and in a few minutes, Hour of the Wolf. Jim Freund here cameoing and free-forming with us. And, Jim, I guess I got to ask you, what you think about what happened this year, and what do you see in the stream of time?
I am the wrong person. I watch social things. I don't watch political the way you do. I have very, very little sense of the news. I have proven myself to be politically, in the big world and especially at WBAI, almost always on the wrong side. I have, you know, the political acumen of a confused hamster. And I know history and all that, and my hindsight is 20/20.
You know, I was at a poker game, and a guy said to me, "How do you play this game?" And that's what I'm hearing from you right now.
Well,
you know a lot of stuff.
No. I know a lot of stuff in the past, and I know a lot of stuff culturally. Mm-hmm. I have both a very good view of very small pictures, an intimate view of them, and I have, I think, a good view of a big, big, big picture. But that means I often don't know what's in front of me. And that's not poker face. I think it's an honest assessment.
Sort of like Magoo Einstein.
Yeah, if you like.
What are your hopes then?
Oh, well, I mean, that's the old, right, you know, what can I say? The hopes are the hopes of everybody since day one, that, you know, people stop acting like people and start acting like real people, you know, like people who love each other instead of people who kill each other, harm each other. The small thinking people that are once again going to be in power. We need to transcend that. It's a very, very broad, stupid statement. It's like, you know, okay, Miss Universe, what do you want? I want peace and love. Well, yeah. Hmm. And then the one thing that I hope that we bring to people on these airwaves is perhaps a little understanding. Hmm. The third part of the famous peace, love, and understanding troika, I hope that both Earth Watch and Hour of the Wolf do that.
And ain't nothing funny about that. Jim Freund. My friend, my colleague, this radio station, you listening, WBAI, all of it comes together right now. I'm Robert Knight. This has been Earthwatch. Thank you for listening. Drop us a note, 120 Wall Street, New York, 1-555, or communicate to rknight, R-K-N-I-G-H-T, at WBAI.org. Also tune in, 5 p.m. Well, I guess it's at 5 o'clock shadow.
Don't shave.
I'm used to close shaves. Stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund coming up. And a little bit of taste of some more Jim Webb. See you next week.
In your hands, and the old men playing checkers by the tree. Arthur Park is melting in the dark, all the sweet green I see blowing down. Someone left the cake out in the rain, and I don't think that I can take it, cause it took so long to bake it, and I'll never have that recipe.
And Earthwatch was brought to you on recording. Robert will be here live, in person. Personal appearance on Earthwatch next week. And we are very, very pleased about that. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. And as befits the start of any of my shows, I'm sitting here having the usual technical difficulties. This one, a minor one, that Robert's show ended about a minute and a half early. And so I fill a little. But as he said so many times during that program, and rightly so, well, this was Freeform. This is Freeform. This is about as free as your form can get. But, here we are. It's about 1:30 in the morning in New York City, and I guess time to start the show, if I can get the darned interview I brought with me working. It'll be suspenseful. Stay tuned. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and, yes, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. I can now say with assurance that we will have the interview I brought with me via another computer. Karen Lord, an interview conducted just about the time. In fact, I did that show talking with Robert Knight. She's wonderful. Stay tuned.
morning. So we have for you a rebroadcast of an interview that I did. This is slightly edited down. I took out about 10 minutes of it because this was one of the last shows, actually, when Hour of the Wolf was still a two-hour show on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. And I had heard from Gavin Grant that he was about to publish a book called Indigo in Redemption by a woman I had not heard of named Karen Lord. And I took one look at her information online and was like, oh my God, of course I'm doing this interview. How amazing. And as you are about to hear, she is an utterly amazing person. And her second novel is about to come out. I was going to be recording another interview with her at World Fantasy this year, which was in Toronto. But it was in Toronto like the day after Hurricane Sandy. And so I just did not make it. We will figure out a way to get Karen Lord live back on the program soon. But here we have this recording, and I thought it would be befitting tonight. I just want to tell you a thing about the way this woman's mind works. She comes up to these studios at 120 Wall Street, where we are going to be for like another 2 weeks, and then we are leaving. We are running with tails and other things between our legs up to a cheaper facility all the way uptown. But we have this incredible view of New York Harbor. And some people would say, oh, what's that there, a helipad? Is that, which buildings are we looking at? This is just north of Wall Street. Where's the African burial ground? There are a lot of different things that people looking out would think of. There's the water taxis. She takes a look, and she said, never having been in New York before, so let me see. The glacier, when it came south, must have cut in over here, and then going north, that's where it created that was called the North River, right? Not the East River. That was called the North River. And I'm going, yes, that's right. She sees glacier movement. She sees planets. She sees people. She sees folklore. She sees wonderful, wonderful things, and she writes about them in wonderful, wonderful ways. And so that's enough of an introduction, because for the rest of it, well, as Bullwinkle would say, just listen. The first question was, and we're going to repeat it, is so tell us a bit about you, yourself. Oh, and first let me start again by thanking Gavin Grant, both for making this interview happen and for publishing this book from Small Beer Press, which he and Kelly Link and Jedediah Berry are among the people that make it happen.
Yes, absolutely. Small Beer Press is really known for finding, he likes to call it, what, slightly weird books? And I suppose that's where this falls, because, yes, it's fantasy, yes, it's speculative fiction, but it comes from a folktale that had no magic in it, and I put in magic. The folktale itself is just two or three chapters, and then I expanded it. The folktales was set in Africa, it's West Africa, and I lifted it up and put it into a world that's kind of vaguely contemporary Earth, but you're never quite sure where it is. So lots of things became sort of slightly weird for that one. But I'm not actually slightly weird, I'm very mundane. I work as a researcher in social sciences usually, but I did decide to try to take fiction writing a bit more seriously, and that's how Redemption and Indigo came about. I will break down and admit that it was NaNoWriMo. It was the National Novel Writing Month that caused me to say, right, sit down, see if you can churn out 1,000, 2,000 words a day, put something together.
And that's actually a lot, isn't it? 1,000 to 2,000 words a day.
It's pretty grueling. Yeah. It feels like work. And I needed something to build it on. I didn't have a fully fledged idea in my head. So I thought, well, there's this folktale I remember from when I was a child, an anthology, the Collier's Junior Encyclopedias, Volume 2, Once Upon a Time. And there was this folktale from West Africa in the sort of Senegambia, Senegal area. And it was about a woman who had a very annoying husband whose habit of gluttony caused him to get into all kinds of scrapes and difficulties and embarrassments. And rather than the happy ever after, meaning, you know, all these two get together and live forever in peace and bliss, it was all about he finally left. She got rid of him and was able to have a life that was no longer plagued by, you know, this highly embarrassing man.
And she lived happily ever after.
So I thought, okay, I'll write about her happily ever after. But in a way, and I guess one of the things that we might have been discussing before, not all fairy tales or folk tales really do have a happy ever after. There's always an edge. And for me, sometimes the edge is that if you have a strength, if you have a talent, and you're called upon to use it more, sometimes those ways are not very comfortable ways. So because I looked at this folk tale and I saw his character and she had this virtue of not only of patience, but a virtue which meant that she was not about to arbitrarily tear down someone's self-esteem to make herself feel good. Mm-hmm. She knew when it was all right to just not act, when it was all right to just, you know, step aside and let things go past for a bit. She might have had the power to be cruel. She might have had the power to make someone's life miserable. And she was able to restrain herself.
An amazing power.
And I think people overlook it. People overlook it. They think, you know, being tough and being powerful is all about causing people harm. And to have that kind of selectivity and that kind of compassion is rare. So the kind of adventure that I gave her afterwards was the adventure that said, right, supposing some people looked at how she handled the situation and said, okay, you know, that's rare for a human. We're going to give her an inhuman power. We're going to give her a power that only the undying ones should have. And then they have to take it from someone else.
Mm.
They take it from an undying one who has forfeited his right to it because he's been not like her. He's been using it improperly. He's been becoming more self-centered. And then it's a battle between the two of them. How is he going to get his power back? How is she going to learn to use it? Is she going to keep it? Is it going to change her or corrupt her? And yes, it's a bit more complex than a happy ever after by then.
And it's a bit more complex also than good versus evil or
precisely
or anything like that. Mm-hmm. This is really an issue that people have to deal with.
Yes. And I do not like good versus evil when the good and the evil are separated into different persons. Because I think a lot of the good versus evil is really the internal struggle, the self. So what you will really find there is a case of they're both struggling to find their better selves, if that doesn't sound too glib.
No.
Yeah.
No, it sounds excellent. I mean, ultimately, the problem is that we have to put all this stuff into words to communicate to our listeners.
Mm-hmm.
And you already had the problem of having this fabulous idea in your head, and you had to commit it to a book,
mm-hmm.
which is a grueling process.
Yes.
And I know people out there listening think, oh, it's just writing.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
No.
No, it's work.
It is work.
And then you have the The issue of relating it to other people
mm-hmm.
in a way that they can understand. And hopefully I have some of the vocabulary
mm-hmm.
of myth and speculative fiction and small presses and all that.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine what it would be like to try and describe this to Doctor.
Something. Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. No.
No. Something you mentioned that I really wanted to expand on. You were talking about having the idea in your head, writing
yeah.
it down, but then getting to the point where you know you have an audience out there to communicate with.
Yes.
I mentioned yes. I wrote the first draft in a month, but believe you me when I say the time for rewriting and editing is far longer than that. It was about a year before I had what I would have called a draft that looked as if it was approaching final. And that came about really because I was speaking to someone who did not have the, what shall we call it? You mentioned a vocabulary of myth and folklore and speculative fiction. I was fortunate enough to be able to run my first draft past a former boss, believe it or not. I used to work in Foreign Service, and the permanent secretary at the time, he also writes. He wrote a play. He asked me to look at it. I looked at it. I critiqued it.